Okay, again, Hebrews chapter 11 is where we find ourselves, and we began our study of that chapter by looking at what faith is. Hebrews chapter 11 in verse 1, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. Perhaps more germane to this part of our study, you'll notice verse 2, the statement that by it the elders obtained a good testimony. Because what we've done is we began in verse 4 and got through verse 10 of our study last week, look at a number of the patriarchs, individuals who lived in the Old Testament, individuals that are spoken of in the Genesis account as individuals of great faith. And as we look at those, we find two things to be the case, and this will continue as you go throughout the 11th chapter. Number one, that the reason why these individuals can be looked upon as paragons, as examples, as we seek to live for Christ, is because of their faith. That's the whole sentiment and thesis of this particular chapter. And then second, that there are various little lessons that can be learned with regard to their expressions of faith, the way in which they responded to God's commands, that will be beneficial to us in application as we go through the text. So that's basically what we're looking at. That the establishment of that fact that these individuals are accepted by God, they've obtained a good testimony because of their faith, and the nature of that faith, what that faith is. And of course, we alluded to the second chapter of James as what we might refer to as a divine commentary upon Hebrews chapter 11, because the two discuss from different sides of the issue the coupling of faith with obedience. The emphasis in Hebrews 11 is on faith, though it is properly described as a faith which is active. Whereas in James chapter 2, the emphasis is upon obedience as a response to faith. But by combining the two passages and looking at them, and we're going to go back and forth on a couple of occasions. We're not going to do that over and over again, but a couple of times. What we will see is what the Bible describes as true faith, faith that is acceptable of God, faith that commends an individual to Him, as it did to the patriarchs, are those who are referred to as the elders in verse 2 of the text, who obtained a good testimony. We've talked already about Abel and Enoch and Noah. We also made reference to Abraham in verse 8 in our study last week, when we were told there that he obeyed when he was called to go out of the place which he would receive as an inheritance. Abraham is actually referred to several times in this regard. Or in this chapter, this particular example of it has to do with early in his life, not early in his life, but early in the Old Testament narrative, where in Genesis chapter 12, he was given instructions by God to leave the place of his forefathers and to go to the land of Canaan that would be given to his descendants. And because of that, he went in and did as he was told. Now, in verse 11 of the text, Hebrews 11, in verse 11, we find his companion, his wife Sarah. And you'll remember that when he was given the promise in Genesis, the 12th chapter, when Abraham was given that promise as he left that land, that number one, he would receive, or his descendants would receive that land as an inheritance. Number two, that a son would be brought forth. It would be through his seed that that a great nation would form, a son of promise. And as that promise is fleshed out and as the narrative continues, we find that Abraham and Sarah were both older, and Sarah had been barren. She had never had a child, and that she was past the age of childbearing. And so it is kind of it's obviously a miracle that she was able to bear the son of promise, who was Isaac. And this particular passage refers to that In verse 11 and 12. So if you'll read with me there, verses 11 and 12 of Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. Now again, this is what we might refer to as the second of those promises. There is, when we look at the when we look at the promises that God gave to Abraham, and by extension, of course, to his wife Sarah as well, there is what we refer to as the land promise, which is alluded to actually in the preceding verses with regard to his dwelling as a sojourner in that land, the land of Canaan, which you'll remember after his descendants inhabited at the time of Joshua. The second promise is with regard to the descendants themselves, that they would be a great nation, that they would be innumerable in number, having reference to the Jewish people. So here is the second of the promise, the land promise, then you have the nation promise. And then you have thirdly, and we'll perhaps have opportunity to talk about that in the future, is the promise concerning the Messiah, that in his seed, all nations of the earth would be blessed. And there is much that the New Testament has to say about the seed promise. So land promise, nation promise, seed promise. You may want to, if you're taking notes or not too familiar with it, to categorize the promises in those three ways. So the nation or the land promise is something that that is mentioned or alluded to there in the preceding verses. Here we find the nation promise. Now there are a couple of things to note with regard to this. First of all, the faith of Sarah, which is stated there in verse 11. By faith Sarah received strength to conceive seed. So we do want to make note of the fact that this was not just a psychosomatic response to God's promise, as some might would think by looking at that phrase. She received strength. The strength that she received was through the faith that she had in God. It was a response of faith, and as such, God blessed her, as the narrative very clearly reveals. But you'll notice that she bore a child when she was past the age. That is, when it was not naturally possible for her to bear the child, and that was, of course, the child of promise, or the son of promise. Promise Isaac. And the reason why she was able to do this, and this is why we understand this is not merely a natural happenstance, but she judged him faithful who had promised. The reason why she was able to obtain this ability, though she was past the age of bearing children, to bear the son of promise, is because of her response of faith. Now, what we want to note here is that when God makes promises, the ability to deliver on those promises comes not from our own abilities, but rather from God's ability. I think that's the good application to make from this text. Let me give you an example that's very applicable to us as Christians today. As we consider the false doctrine of the security of the believer, the Calvinistic view that once a person is responsive to the gospel and is saved, that he is always saved. It's referred to as once saved, always saved, the impossibility of apostasy, the security of the believer. By the way, I do believe in the security of the believer. I just do not believe in the Calvinistic doctrine of that. But the Calvinist will teach that an individual who responds in faith, that God saves him, and once God saves him, there is no way for him to forfeit his standing with God. It doesn't matter how he lives his life or what comes after that. That once you are saved, you are always saved. Now we, of course, have on a number of occasions and even recently discussed these things. In fact, within the epistle that Paul wrote to the Hebrews in chapters 5 and 6, we discussed in some detail the possibility of an individual who is a child of God forfeiting his standing before God and losing his soul as a result of that. So there is the danger of it. There is an opposite extreme that some take, so that when you talk to them, they seem to be somewhat miserable with regard to their expression of Christian faith. And as you discuss that, it is because they lack confidence in their standing before God. You ask them if they're if they feel confident that they're going to heaven, and they say they really don't feel confident. They hope that they'll go to heaven. And by the way, they misuse the biblical concept of hope when they say that. What they mean by that is they're wishing for it and they're desiring it, but they really don't know. They don't know if they're accepted of God. They don't know if they're going to make it. When I look at the expression of the Apostle Paul, for example, and John does the exact same thing, Peter does as well, but the Apostle Paul uses the phrase, "I know." He said, "I know in whom I have believed and am persuaded that he's able to keep what I've committed to him until that day." He stated with assurance, "I have fought the good fight. I have kept the race. I have kept the faith. I finished the race, kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness." So Paul spoke with very great confidence concerning his standing with God. Well, why is that? Was that because he was inspired? Was it because he was an apostle? Well, there's no indication of that at all, that was the case. He spoke with confidence because he had finished the race. He had kept the faith. He had followed that course. And as such, he was confident. And the confidence was not in himself. When you look at the Apostle Paul, what he very clearly establishes time and again is that his confidence in his standing is not based upon himself. He called himself a wretched man, an insolent man, and one who was wholly dependent upon the grace of God for salvation. But he had confidence in the promises that had been granted him. "I know in whom I have believed and am persuaded that he's able to keep what I've committed." God promises salvation to those who are obedient to him, those who are faithful to him. And as we express our confidence in our standing with God, it's not based upon the perfection of our life. It is based upon the gift of grace. And as that grace has been extended to us, and as we seek to serve him, as we ask forgiveness for our sins, we can lay our head on the pillow at night and be confident that if the Lord takes us, that we will be with him. That's a confidence that we as Christians can and should have. And John, in his epistles, you'll go through this, and he not only says, like Paul did, is, "I know," in whom he says, "We know." We know. We can know these things. We can be assured of them because they are based in God rather than in ourselves. And that's exactly the way it was with regard to Sarah. Now, you do remember that Sarah had some doubts initially, that Sarah was actually a bit taken aback at this idea that she would give birth. But she finally came to that acknowledgement that God can do what he's promised, and that if she would trust in him, that he would accomplish his purposes in her. And it's at that trust that, and again, this is not our statement. This is the statement of inspiration, because she judged him faithful. God is the one who had promised, and she understood and recognized that because it's God, he could and would do what he said he would do for her. And because of that, she indeed receive strength to conceive seed. So this indicates that the reason why the promise of God was fulfilled is because of the faith of Sarah. She believed, and as a result of her faith and her belief, God did as he promised he would do. And we can say the same thing. If we believe in God, and it is a response of faith that we grant to him, then we can be assured of the promises that he delivers to us. So we can have that same type of confidence. Anybody want to comment or question about that specific verse? There's a second point that I want to make from the 12th verse, but concerning Sarah's faith in verse 11 and the statement made there. Anybody? Okay, then if you'll notice in verse 12 of the text, it refers back to the promise that was granted initially in the 12th chapter of Genesis to Abraham. As a result of Sarah's response of faith from one man that's having reference to Abraham, her husband, and him as good as dead, and that is, again, Abraham was an old man when Isaac was conceived, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is beside the seashore. And so we see that this promise that God granted, that second promise of a great nation, of many descendants, it was accomplished through the faith of Sarah. And there is the tie-in that is found in verses 11 and 12 of the text. But you may again want to note. In fact, let's just, as we've got time to do so, turn quickly over to Genesis chapter 12 and just look at the promise that is granted there. The first two of those promises are both mentioned in the instructions that God gives to Abraham. And of course, at that time, it was Abram. And you'll notice actually in chapter 11 in verse 30, at this time again, their names were known as Abram and Sarai, S-A-R-A-I. You'll notice in verse 30, we're told that Sarai, or it may still be pronounced Sarah, but without the H, she was barren and had no child. And so we're told in verse 1 of chapter 12 that the Lord said to Abram, get out from your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. You shall be to me a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Now, there are all three of the promises that are alluded to, at least in this text, though the statement concerning the land, it is more explicitly stated a bit later. But you'll notice in verse 1, the statement, if you leave your country and leave your family and your father's house, you will go to a land that I will show you. That's the land of Canaan. And he promised that that land would be granted to his descendants. Now, Abraham, as we alluded to in our study last week, spent the entirety of his life as a pilgrim and a sojourner in that land. That is, he did not inhabit it. He did not own it. He was simply a visitor in that country. But his descendants later, in the campaigns that Joshua led, subjugated the land, and it became theirs. The second thing in verse 2, the second promise, he said, I will make you a great nation. And again, the thing about this is that, just so that you'll understand what he's saying, you go to this strange land, spend your time there, a great nation is going to come from you. And we already know that Sarah was barren. In other words, it was something that had already been established. And so it was not just that Abram was told and went, not knowing where he was going, but he also went, not knowing how the other promise would possibly be fulfilled, because Sarah was barren and he was an older man. So we're told in verse 5 that, verse 4, Abram departed as the Lord had spoken. He was 75 years old when he departed from Haran, and he took Sarah his wife and Lot his brother's son and all their possessions that they had gathered and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. And he spent the rest of his life there in that land. Okay, so those are the promises as stated in chapter 12, and we find the fulfillment of both of those first two. We find the response of faith, and then, of course, as we go through the rest of the Old Testament narrative, we find the fulfillment of those promises that God was faithful with regard to those things. But here in verses 11 and 12, we find the allusion to Isaac's birth. Now, the next section of Scripture, beginning in verse 13 and going through verse 16, is a bit of an interim summary statement. I don't even know if that makes sense, but what happens is he takes a break from the narrative to make a point that actually is established throughout in the verses following as well. Any questions at all verses 11 and 12?
Actually, when Abraham left, he went on faith itself just by going out there.
Sure.
And doing what he done.
That's right. He didn't know what it was going to be like. He didn't know how God was going to fulfill the promises that he's going to. In fact, as we'll see in the next section of Scripture, he lived and he died and had been dead for a long, long time before his descendants finally took the land, because the land was never his. But he did it in faith. He was looking long term rather than.
That's why I noticed.
That's right.
He just was there and he took everybody with him. I guess everybody followed him because of what he wanted faith and what God was
telling him. Yeah, I think that, and that's another good lesson for us. He was the patriarch. He was the head of that part of that group. He had those above him in the sense of the family that are mentioned in the previous. But he left his father's house. He established, in effect, his own household. But he had an influence on, well, literally millions of people but even at that time there was a household, the individual, all the possessions they had gained, all of the people that they had. So it was a big household that he took with him. And he had a great influence on Lot. He had a great influence on Sarah, his wife, and also on his servants as he went into that land. And again, the narrative is very clear on that. Lot, it was his nephew. Yes, Lot was his nephew. Dick, did you have something? I think that's the reference, but even
Romans 4:19 spells out exactly. In fact, it covers 11 and 12 here. Romans 4:19 talks about the same thing about Sarah and Abraham.
Yeah, well, you understand that at that age that they were past the time. Now, there's a difference with regard to a woman being barren and biologically and unable to give birth. But you'll notice and there is that reference, Romans 4:19, that not being weak in faith, he did not consider his own body already dead since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. Of course, that is the reference there in Hebrews 11 to verse 12, as good as dead. It was at that point in time. Now, not at the point in time that the promise was made at the age of 75, because you do remember that Sarah and Abraham initially sought to assist God by giving Sarah's handmaiden Hagar to Abram as a wife, and he fathered a natural child, an Ishmael. But that happened a number of years before the son of promise came along. So this was a while happening. So the Bible in two different places, Romans 4 as well as Hebrews chapter 11, indicates that not only was Sarah barren in the sense that she was not only unable to conceive, but she was past the age of conception, but also that Abram at this point in time did not have the ability to father a child naturally. And that's the reference in both those cases. That's true. Well, yeah. Okay, well, then perhaps it's just a reference to the way it should have been or would have been in under normal circumstances. Yes?
Talking before about Abraham going, believing God and going, we've said it before, I think, but the two things together kind of equal faith, is the believing. I think that's what Hebrews 11 is all about, is the believing what God says and then doing what he says. And either one by itself doesn't really constitute the full definition of faith.
Yeah.
It's a component of it. Yeah. And Sarah, and maybe on first glance, she said, well, maybe Sarah just believed, but I'm thinking just that the activity involved in conceiving a child and bearing one and raising one is a sure constitutes of activity.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that will become obvious and is more obvious and overt in other examples that we'll find through the text of Hebrews 11. As you look in James 2, I mean, that's the point that James makes. Faith together with works justifies a man. And in fact, again, just so that we'll recognize this, as you go in Hebrews 11 verse 2, as we alluded to earlier, it is by faith that the elders obtained a good testimony. What that phrase, they obtained a good testimony, a single word that defines that phrase very clearly is they were justified. That's what justification is that you obtain that good testimony that you please God. That's a good way of defining justification. So when you look at James 2 and you say that by faith alone, no man is justified. It is faith coupled with works. And the reference there, of course, is to obedience. That individuals are justified. The elders obtained a good testimony because of the response of their faith. They not only believed, but they did as God required of them. They kept their end of the bargain, in other words. And as a result of that, God blessed them as he promised he would.
What was it? It was a lot of the other ones did sort of maybe more spectacular things. You know? And if you just look at Sarah, at first glance, you say, well, she believed and she had the child. Well, I don't think you just don't have a child.
Yeah.
It's not just a passive thing. Belief was all that was involved in her case, either.
Yeah.
And it might be overlooked. I don't know if you just
look Good point.
At Sarah's case. It's a little different than
Yeah, it's not as overt as some of the others. Yeah. Good point. Okay, let's go now to verses 13 through 16. And I want to read them as a group and just make note of a couple of things contained in that text. We're told in verse 13 that these all died in faith. So he's mentioned already Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, and Sarah. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confess that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Now, there is, I think, a very direct application that can be made with regard to Abraham and Sarah, or at least a correlation that you can look at as to their willingness to go and to sojourn in a land that was not theirs because of, and the fact that they lived and died without having received that promise of the land, because of what, you know, they were looking forward to. So there, in some of the language, there is a direct correlation with regard to it. But I want you to note that when it said these all, that it's not referencing just Abraham and Sarah. It's referencing Abel and Enoch and Noah as well. And so we have to understand the passage to be inclusive of them. And yet the language is something that, if we were to make a direct application, might be specifically referring to the promise that was given to Abraham. They all died in faith, not having received the promises. Well, you know, the reference with regard to Abel, as we look back, is the offering of a more excellent sacrifice, and he obtained witness that he was righteous. God testified of his gifts. Well, he received that there in his life. That was actually something that obtained before his death. That specific thing, that God was pleased with his sacrifice and accepted it, but God was wroth with Cain because of his disobedience. Enoch, the specific reference here is because of his righteousness and his response of faith, God took him. So as regards to an actual blessing or benefit of faith, he experienced that. He did not die, but rather he went to be with God. So there is the fulfillment of that promise. And then Noah, the specific reference here is the fact that in the preparation of the ark, he condemned the world and became the heir of righteousness. Well, that happened again during his lifetime in the sense that the flood came and he passed through the flood with his family and came out the other side and was given the responsibility to replenish the earth. But those are what we might refer to as physical blessings or spiritual blessings obtained while on earth, and are not the point that he's making here. These individuals and what he's referring to, and by the way, by application, we can go on to Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Rahab, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, the prophets, and then all the others that are unnamed there in the latter part of the list. All of these individuals lived and died in faith before Christ came, before the redemptive act of God was completed, before the scheme of redemption was completely unveiled and unfolded for mankind. They lived and died before the promise of salvation came through the sending of the Son, the gift of God's grace. And that's the reference here. And that's the specific point. And so the language that is found in verses 13 through 16 is actually restated at the end of the chapter. I want you to notice in verses 39 and 40. These are parallel passages. 13 through 16 and 39 and 40 are parallel. He said all of these, and again, now he's included, in addition to these five that we've mentioned already, all the rest that I read to you a few moments ago. All of these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. So the significance of verses 13 through 16 is that these individuals, they were wonderful examples of faith because from the very beginning of time, you can go to the very, very early on in the text of Genesis. You'll remember the various statements that were made as response to the sin of Adam and Eve. You can go all the way to Genesis to the third chapter in verse 15. The Lord had cursed the serpent in verse 14 of the text, and as a part of that curse, that you would be on your belly and eat dust all the days of your life. He makes reference to a conflict that would exist always between Satan, the devil, and man, and specifically Satan and the seed of woman, having reference to the man, Jesus Christ, I believe. But this, I think, is the first example of the prophecies that we have in the Old Testament about a Messiah. In this, he said, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed, and he shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. This, again, was at the very beginning in the Garden of Eden, where there was that promise that there would be a conflict that would exist between seed. And in fact, if you have it is an interpretation of it, and I understand that to be the case, but in my Bible, at least, in the translation of Genesis 3:15, the word seed, having reference to the seed of woman, is actually in capital, indicating that their view is that the seed has reference to the Messiah. I think that that is the case, and I think Paul's discussions of the concept or the idea of the seed of woman would indicate that is true. But this is the point that I'm making. From the very beginning of time, God had it in his mind. Ephesians chapter 1 indicates that before the world began, God had ordained the redemption of man through the shed blood of Jesus Christ. It was his scheme of redemption throughout the entirety of man's existence. Before man ever sinned, there was a plan in place to make provision for sin because God knew of its inevitability. So, man sins, man's lost, man's in need of a redeemer. The redeemer did not come until the fullness of time, as recorded in Matthew, the first chapter. When the woman, having reference to the Virgin Mary, was with child and conceived and gave birth and brought forth Elohim, God with us. So there is that, or Emmanuel, God with us. So there is that text in Matthew 1 indicating Jesus coming into this world. All these individuals lived and died before that happened. Before Jesus came, before he lived his life, before he died on the cross, before he ascended from or resurrected from the dead. All of those things happened after these individuals lived and died. And that's the point here. So since that is the case, it becomes clear as to what is referred to in verses 15 and 16 when it's told, or verse 14 starting off, that they declared or they seek a homeland. So they were seeking a homeland. Verse 15, if they had thought about, focused on the country from which they had come, they could have returned. Now again, there's that specific reference. You had Abram and Sarah that departed from Haran. They spent their entirety of their lives in Canaan. They could have looked back and said, you know, I'm tired of living in tents. I'm tired of not having a place to call my own. I'm tired of being a pilgrim and a sojourner. I want to go back to the land of my fathers. I want to go back to that place. And they could have returned. But that's not where the focus of Abraham was. It wasn't the focus of Abel. It wasn't the focus of Enoch. It wasn't the focus of Noah. Abraham's focus, instead, you'll notice, was on a homeland that was yet future. He said, now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. And so there we find clearly described that their focus and their desire was not on what was offered on earth, but what they could obtain after their lives on earth. And that focus, stated in verse 16, that heavenly country, a city that has been prepared, that is yet unrealized, that will be realized in heaven, is where their focus was and our focus should be. And as such, they serve as a wonderful example to us. And that, I think, is the primary point of all this. Now, we have an advantage, and I think verses 39 and 40 are indicating that. We have an advantage today because we are post-cross. We are after the cross. We live now in a time to where we have the entire scheme of redemption unfolded for us, where they saw through a veil darkly, not having a full understanding or comprehension of how God was going to accomplish his promises. We know. We have that full revelation of how it happened and what it means to us. And so we have an advantage over them in that we have that full understanding. But the focus is to be exactly the same as it was for them. We are to consider ourselves pilgrims and sojourners in a strange country. That is, that we are not at home on earth, but rather we'll be at home in heaven, and that our focus should be on that which is in heaven. And when an individual apostatizes, when you've got a Christian who becomes a child of God and then falls away, it is identical to that statement there in verse 15. They had a country that they had come out of, and they desired to go back to it. Remember Demas? Because it's actually a statement the Apostle Paul makes that is almost parallel to it, almost identical to it. Demas, he said, has forsaken me, having loved the present world. Demas had come out of the world, but after a period of time, he had forsaken Paul, and by extension, forsaken his responsibilities to God because he desired the world. He wanted to go back into the world. His focus had changed. He was looking at this life rather than the life to come. It's a wonderful passage of scripture, verses 13 through 16, and again, enlarged upon, not only in verses 39 and 40, but also as you continue on in chapter 12 and verses 1 and 2. Hebrews 12, 1 and 2 is basically the conclusion of this 11th chapter. I understand that a chapter change is made here, but the thought is not changed. He's simply making application of all the things that they've learned in chapter 11. And he says in verse 12, 1, or chapter 12, verse 1, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, in other words, since we have learned what we've learned from these individuals in chapters 11, he said, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus. So, consider this. The focus is on the homeland. Our focus is on Jesus, who is the author and the finisher of our faith. As we keep our focus on Christ and look to him, then we have that same hope that they had, and we're looking in the same direction that they did. All right? Okay, so does anyone have any questions or comments concerning verses 13 through 16 of Hebrews chapter 11 that you want to add to what we've already discussed at this point? Yes, Roger.
Just a little bit. I was listening to the radio this morning on the way to worship, and it was one of these shows where they're all talking about real estate and how to make money and how to preserve your retirement funds and pay less taxes and all of that business. And it was just, you know, half hour of total materialism. And then at the end of the show, when the guy signed off, he says, and remember, we're one day closer to home. And, you know, throughout all that, this character who was making his living talking about materialistic things was able to keep his focus about where his home was. It wasn't that piece of property that he was talking about how to get for the least money or pay the least taxes on. It was in heaven. I don't know what his total religious outlook was, but he had that part of it right.
Yeah, at least the sentiment was the correct sentiment. Yeah.
And I, when we're here and we're all together, I think a lot about heaven. When I'm studying the Bible, I think a lot about heaven. You know, through the day, through the week, sometimes you kind of get distracted by things. You know, you always think about where your home is. You think about stuff that's going on right in front of you on this plane. And, I just thought it'd be kind of nice if we could sign off every day with thinking that we're one day closer.
Yeah.
One day closer to home.
Yeah, and I'll make another application of that same point. I think that the religious world has become distracted by the things on this earth. I think that you've heard of the phrase the social gospel, and it's kind of an interesting thing that if you look back into because this is, by the way, an American phenomenon, or at least it had its origin in America, the social gospel. The idea of the social gospel actually was not fun and frolic, as it's been, I think, distorted to at our time. It's basically a view that's held by such organizations as the Salvation Army, to where the most important thing that we can do in the purpose of religion is to make our world better. And so when you're talking about the social gospel, you're talking about actually the church, at least in the view of these individuals, being activated for what are actually very, very beneficial works of benevolence. And, for example, and involving oneself in the community and establishing church institutions that would involve themselves in education and benevolent activities and so on and so forth. You know, people today, when they talk about it, again, it has been distorted somewhat. I remember listening to a quote youth minister. Well, he actually wasn't a youth minister at that time. He'd gone beyond that. But he talked about his days as a youth minister in Dallas-Fort Worth. And he said that he was the first youth minister in Fort Worth, Texas. I'm thinking to myself, you know, first one. Okay, you know, we've been 2,000 years without a youth minister, and all of a sudden you are one. Does that give you an idea that maybe that's not a biblical position? But he was talking about all the things that he and they accomplished in the ministry that they had for the young. And he said, and he invited everyone, he said, I want y'all to help me bring up Christian youth in a Christian way with Christian education and Christian recreation and he was emphasizing the need for those kinds of things, and even used the idea of recreation. Giving our kids a place to go and to play that is, in effect, sponsored by the church. And it's a work of the church. Now, it is a work of the Christian to make sure that his children have a moral and righteous atmosphere that they're raised in and activities to engage in. It's not the church's work. But they have the idea that we need to do this, quote, for the kids, or we need to do this for the poor, we need to do this for... You know, and the idea is that the church needs to be involved in what is, in fact, worldly and secular pursuits. And it's a laudable idea in the sense that they're trying to better people's lives, but it is not a good work because it is not the work that God gave the church to do. And so when they do it on their own authority rather than by the authority of God. And we're given instructions instead to do what God tells us to do. And as a church, the responsibility of the church is to evangelize and edify. That is, the church's work is to get people to heaven. That's what the church is for. Families and other organizations make life better on earth, but the reason the church exists is to get them to heaven. The focus needs to be there. The focus of us as Christians needs to be on heaven. We may not ever be real comfortable in this life, and I'm talking physically. We also should never be comfortable in this life in the sense that we feel we belong here. Our focus ought to always be on spiritual things, the heavenly things, and if we get it right, then we're better off. But I think not only individually do we mess that up, but I think the world in general has missed it with regard to God's calling and the concept of salvation through grace. It's a lowering of the standard, in effect. Lowering of the focus. We're not looking at the heavenly country. We're looking at this country. And we make a mistake when we do that. All right, was that second bell or first bell? First bell, okay. All right, anybody else comments, questions about verses 13 through 16? All right, we don't have time really to go on beyond that. If you'll notice, as we get into verses 17 and following, Abraham's brought up again, this time with regard to the offering up of his son Isaac. That's where I'm going to... Let Dennis take over, because he's going to be teaching our class next Sunday morning. And Hebrews 11:17 is where you'll start that time. And Debbie and I are going to be out of town next Sunday. So Dennis will be teaching the class and preaching in the morning. Joshua will be preaching in the evening. And I'll give my thanks to them before, in case I forget to thank them afterwards. If there are no other comments, questions at this time, we'll go ahead and dismiss the class now. Thank you for coming today.